Welcome back to Research Talk. My name is Anna Vernon. I'm the head of research at JIS Licensing. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Banks, Director of Library Services at Imperial College London, and Professor Stephen Curry, Consul Faculty, Natural Sciences and Cross College Organisation, and Professor of Structural Biology, also from Imperial College. In this episode, we'll be talking about the critical review of transitional open access agreements. We'll focus on the reactions to the review, what the review means to the research sector, and the feasibility of achieving a more open research culture. I'll move on to introductions now, and I'll start with myself. So I lead JIS Licensing's negotiations for research tools, software and content on behalf of the UK academic sector, and I'm part of the team that worked on the critical review. Steve and Chris, could you introduce yourselves and perhaps where open access, open research intersects with your roles?
Yes, I mean, my interest, I guess, I mean, obviously I'm an academic, but I'm not research active anymore, but I have really got into this area through starting a scientific blog and starting to write about it and became very interested in open access and then the link that that has to research assessment. And these two issues are very tightly tied together because we operate in a prestige economy. So I've just actually finished a 6-year term of office as chair of the Declaration on Research Assessment, which is an advocacy organization that was very much trying to improve approaches to research assessment. And clearly our obsession with prestige titles and high impact factor journals is something that still needs to be tackled. And I've also just started a new role part-time as Director of Strategy at the Research on Research Institute. And so there are many areas related to scholarly communication and the ways that it is used and the efficiencies and inefficiencies within it that come into the purview of that institute. So it's a very interesting time to be working in this area.
How about you, Chris?
So I'm Director of Library Services. So our connection with open access and open research is in part through the provision of services to the researchers to support open access publishing. Our world is moving much more also into the sort of open research, open data, research culture, and of course, on the provision of access to content and to publishing services, I'm very heavily involved in, particularly at a national level, in some of the negotiations for some of our read and some of these read and publish agreements that we're going to be talking about today.
Thank you. So I'll kick off with our first question. What was your reaction when you read the review? I'll start with you first, Stephen.
Well, first of all, I mean, I'm very pleased to see that the review took place because I think these are important questions that we need to look at. Obviously, I think in the UK, you know, the policy has been evolving over the last 10 years or more. You know, there is a commitment to open access that we see from the government and from UKRI. There's very much a strong push to enabling gold or a preference for gold OA, although other mechanisms do apply. And so I was, you know, pleased to see that this is still a live issue and one that we are tackling very analytically. And I mean, I guess we'll get into the nuts and bolts of the review, but there were some very interesting findings. And I think it's anticipated that this will be, when it's finally published, I guess in early 2024, food for further discussion around how exactly we get towards an OA destination. So we've moved quite some way along the road. So there's been a lot of positive developments, not just from this policy, but of course we operate in an international landscape where there's been a lot of positive action around open access and open science. I think of Plan S, but also, you know, the UNESCO recommendations on open science. And so, you know, this is, I guess the report has a UK focus, but there's very clearly an international landscape that we're operating in. And I don't know whether we are leading or lagging in that. I think it depends very much on your point of view, but I think really good to see that, you know, JISC is engaging deeply with these issues.
Thank you. And I think that point around UKRI compliance and the international angle is a really interesting one, actually, because there are so many lenses you can apply to transitional agreements, open access, and also the reach of these agreements as well, that I think one of the difficulties with us in coming up with the report is just limiting the number of lenses we can apply. And I think one of the things we want to do is related to eating our own dog food, I suppose, is making the data openly available, releasing the report so that we can then make the report openly available and so that others can draw other conclusions as well. Over to you, Chris.
Thanks. I sort of have mixed feelings. I mean, like Steve and I absolutely welcome the report and the very, very detailed analysis that has been undertaken as part of that report. I think if I look at it, if I stay within the UK for a moment, our sort of the first that UKRI, what was RCUK, they have had that preference for gold since the Finch report, which I think was around 2012. And I think it's interesting to note that other funders have not taken that route. Mm-hmm. I think what we have seen in the period since 2012 is that alignment of funder policies, which has certainly been very welcomed, that alignment, and also that alignment around immediate open access, I think is very helpful, and the various routes. What concerns me about the findings are that I'm not sure that we're seeing a meaningful move of the dial, if I put it that way. So a lot of funding has gone into supporting what should have been a transition. And I think the report reveals that we are really not seeing that transition from hybrid to fully open access. And what that funding appears to have supported is more a move from author accepted manuscript version open access, so green open access, to effectively what is hybrid publishing. But what we're not seeing out the other end is that transition from hybrid to fully open access. And the fact that, you know, the earliest that transition is likely to take is 72 years off, I think is really very deeply worrying. And that's possibly coupled with what we're seeing internationally, where the funder approach is a different one. And so I guess my thinking is, you know, can the UK continue to operate alone in this, where should we be looking more internationally as we think about what does a true transition to immediate open access mean? And for that, we then have to also look at the fact that we are undoubtedly baking in a new kind of inequity, not inequitable access to publishing opportunities in the UK, because not all UK institutions can afford to sign up to the agreements that we've been reaching, but also increasing that global inequity of access to publishing opportunities. And so those are the things that I think we're in a real danger of moving from a point where we have inequity of access to reading to inequity of access to publishing opportunities. And whilst the likes of UKRI and Wellcome Funding may have supported their own authors, I do wonder whether that is then skewing it for other nations and other researchers where similar funding opportunities are not available to them.
Yeah, thank you. So, Chris, you spoke about meaningfully moving the dial when it comes to the open access transition and moving from what still is the subscriptions paywall system to open access. From your perspective, what have been the main challenges or barriers?
One of the challenges is that we, rather than rethinking the model, we are still very dominated by what's not far off a sort of 17th century model of publication and of research dissemination. And so there's a fundamental thing there, that there hasn't been that shift. We are still being served up with journals, with page numbers on them, with indexes to each issue, with volume numbers. And whilst there are incredibly good examples of publishers who are seeking to change that model, I would look at initiatives like Wellcome Open Research, where the research dissemination is supported by the funder. I would look at PLOS, which looks to publishing well-evidenced science rather than seeking to identify the very, very, very novel science. But equally, I would observe that the funders are putting larger packages of funding together to support great big global initiatives. And at the end of that, the results of the funding gets atomized into hundreds and hundreds of research articles, maybe placed in many different journals. So we've got that, you know, funder funding a big global challenge, and then that atomization of the results, rather than as Sir Mark Walpert described a number of years ago, you know, acknowledging the fact that research builds, each piece of research builds on the research that others have done, and yet somehow we continue to atomize that, and we continue to communicate it in a sort of 17th century manner, even to the extent where if it's in color, we get charged separately for color. In an internet pixel world. And moving that dial is as hard as you know, any of those new models taking root, gaining traction. And this is where, you know, we will probably loop quite quickly around to the perceived reward mechanisms, the continued perceived publish or perish. And the other work that needs to be done, and which of course Stephen has been leading on for such a while, which is on, you know, looking at those new research assessment principles and how can we put those into practice, and how can they then contribute to thinking about the dissemination of research and the evaluation of research and research contribution in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree that, you know, that is actually, for me, that is one of the sort of still the main challenges, you know, is that we are 10 years down the line with DORA, and we've seen the emergence of the European-led sort of coalition for advancing research assessment, which I think is doing some really good work in practical terms. But we're still a long way yet from researchers on the ground having the confidence to sort of publish their research, you know, wherever, you know, in the most appropriate journal for dissemination to the audience that needs to see it. But then, you know, not fearing that they will be judged based on the name or the impact factor or the reputation, shall we say, of the journal that they're publishing in. And so that, because that prestige economy still exists, I think it's, you know, the window is moving and discussions are moving. And, you know, it has, you know, it certainly has changed over the last 5 to 10 years, but we're still not entirely there. And that, of course, gives quite a deal of power to established, particularly commercial publishers who make good money in scholarly communication. I mean, the main ones are, you know, creaming off 30 to 40% margins, and some profit margin obviously is necessary to maintain a business, but there are very few international businesses out there that make profits of that kind of level. And so they are, you know, quite naturally and quite rightly seeking to defend their hegemony. And as I think we've seen through this report, then they're still claiming commercial confidentiality. They're not sharing their data. And so it's very difficult to see exactly where do the costs lie, what exactly are the costs that are incurred in delivering sort of open access through published journals. And so there's a power dynamic in operation in which the research community is still not fully apprised of. I mean, it's, and I think part of that is just, you know, people are busy. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so they just don't have the time for all these sort of policy debates, and which are often quite complex. You know, if you're from a standing start, it's probably really quite difficult as a researcher to really to get into the space and to understand all the different challenges. But I think, you know, more and more the conversation is changing slowly. There's a lot of debate now, yet again, around Plan S, because they actually come out with principles with regard to the responsibilities that researchers should have. And I think they're obviously trying to clear a space for a more scholar-led type of ecosystem, one that would still have room for commercial players, but actually one where we might try to establish a more functional market than the one that exists at the minute, which depends still very much on the prestige economy. So it's those power dynamics that we do need to try and unlock. And I think, you know, the evidence of this report is really showing that we've not yet gone nearly far enough to trying and unlock and rebalance the power dynamic. I mean, I think, for example, I mean, one of the other things that will come into play in the next few years, I hope, will be the gradual or increased or hopefully accelerating uptake of rights retention policies by universities, which Chris has been a real powerhouse in developing and delivering. And now even Imperial College has signed up to such a policy. And I think that in itself will help to foster more conversations on the part of researchers about, you know, what is it that they're actually doing when they give their services as editors and as reviewers to commercial entities who are making an awful lot of money based on their freely given labor. And I guess one of the distinctions that the report pulls out is that actually societally led publishers look to be operating in a more proactive way about setting out a plan to flip their journal, to use the transitional arrangement in transitional terms. And what we're not seeing from the commercial players, I mean, Chris mentioned earlier the fact that the forecast that on at the current rate of going, Wiley, which is the only really large publisher that's actually shared the data and shared its plan, it's going to take them 72 years to flip all their journals to open access through this arrangement. And that's simply not fast enough. But of course, we've not heard from Springer Nature. We've not heard from Elsevier. We've not heard from Taylor and Francis. And they are obviously, they're playing a very clever game, but I'm afraid it's a game that is not necessarily in the interests of the research community and not actually in the interests of the public that is ultimately funding an awful lot of this research and funding an awful lot of the publishing operations. I mean, there are real costs associated with organizing peer review and publishing and disseminating results. And as a community, we should absolutely be paying those costs. But I think we need to have a much clearer idea about where those costs come from and how they might be rebalanced in a world that is a bit more equitable.
Thank you. So this is a question for Chris. So if we continue with transitional agreements in their current form, what do you think this means for the sector and what may or may not happen as a result of continuing down this current path?
So I think one of the opportunities in the short term, I think one of the opportunities that we have is to return to the criteria that we have for our transitional or, and I'm almost not going to call them transitional deals because we aren't there isn't a sign of a transition. So I'm going to call them read and publish agreements. But I think we have an opportunity to review further whether the criteria are currently fit for purpose, whether there's anything that we can do with those criteria to increase the equity. And in particular, we might have an opportunity to have a think about how we can do that, at the very least in the UK. But what we might ask publishers to be doing in terms of equitable publishing, in terms of their sustainability, and I mean global sustainability rather than the sustainability of profit margins. So I think we've got that opportunity to review those. So there's lots of discussion going on in the sector about alternative approaches. I mean, one of the questions we've asked ourselves, I ask myself a lot, is what value do we put on very, very sometimes no use content for which we are paying for in some of these large, big deals? We essentially have a big read and publish deal. But there are many outlets where we're not publishing and there are many outlets where we're not reading. But what value do we place on that? And actually, is a different sized deal something that we should be looking at within the UK? But that's all very, very short term, because I think the other opportunity we have, and this data will be this data presented in the report and other data that we as universities are beginning to look at, which is effectively if we take all the money that we spend on publishing activities, where is that money going and where do we want it to go? You know, is a lot of it just in read-only and do we want much more of it to head down into what I'll call the diamond end of the spectrum? And how might we achieve that? You know, how can we make sure that we transition our expenditure so that it is supporting much more equitable publishing? So I think we've got the data that we're seeing on the performance of the agreements, but also the data that we now have on where we are spending our money. And we can have conversations about how can we rebalance that so that it does start shifting the dial in the direction of more equitable publishing.
Thank you, Chris. And I know that we've been having a lot of discussions with institutions. So you mentioned the diamond model. So that's the free to read, free to publish in models and how we can scale those up so that there is genuine equitable access to publishing opportunities as well. Chris, you spoke about opportunities and I wanted to pick up on that theme with Stephen actually around, you know, what are the opportunities that moving away from this prestige economy, publish or perish, provides to a researcher in their discipline? What are the benefits to moving away and from using possibly a quite untested platform or mode of sharing their work?
I mean, I don't think that it is necessarily untested. I mean, open access is a norm now, I would say, within the UK. And part and parcel of that, and one of the things that one might think about shifting to is greater uptake of the use of preprints, you know, which we've seen has been in many physics disciplines for a long time. And now there's strong uptake within the sort of biomedical sciences with bioarchive and medarchive. And there are other preprint servers emerging in other disciplines. And so that, you know, that's been a big change. And I think obviously the experience of the publishing practices during the COVID pandemic have shown people what tremendous value there is in that. And I know there are some concerns, and I think particularly in medical fields, that, you know, if non-peer-reviewed research is published, then, you know, maybe clinical practice develops that's based on research that is a bit shoddy. But I think that's not really a big risk, to be perfectly honest, because any researcher who is jealous or careful for their professional reputation, you know, they pour their heart and soul into their papers. And so, you know, and while I agree that peer review is a useful mechanism for improving papers, I don't think that in the vast majority of cases, it makes or breaks a paper. Okay, most papers, I would estimate, based on my own experience as an author and as a reviewer, you know, they're improved at the level of 5 or 10% by peer review. And that's an improvement worth having. But that just shows you, I think, what tremendous value there can be in preprint servers. And so, you know, I think also the fact that the research community is sharing information more rapidly and more openly so that everybody can read it, I think that helps to stimulate interdisciplinary research, because then, you know, traditionally, you know, if you're in a disciplinary silo, you're in a department of physics or chemistry or biology, then the different journals that you can access is very limited by your library budget. And if things are open access, then you have a much bigger audience, not just in your own country, but of course across the world. And so that stimulates exchange, and, you know, research is always a process of building on earlier findings. And the more that you can access those findings, the more rapidly you can go. I mean, there's another thing, which is, and again, I was pleased to see in the Plan S principles that they announced back in October. And the first one is that, you know, researchers are responsible for the dissemination of research findings. Now, researchers do like to go on an awful lot about the freedoms that they claim to have and their academic freedom. And some would tell you that part of that academic freedom is to choose to publish in this or that outlet. Now, I think there's an argument for understanding, acknowledging that many researchers, you know, they have professional knowledge and they should be free to choose particular journals because they know that will reach a particular disciplinary community. But of course, what happens in reality is that because of the operation of the prestige economy, people will submit to the highest impact factor journal they can think of. And when they're rejected from there, they revise and resubmit and they go through multiple cycles. And I think what the public doesn't realize is that we are happily playing this game and we are happily delaying the publication by 12 months, by 18 months of work that is ready to be published, ready to be read, but we hold it back in order to win the prestige and career points. And I think if that was more understood by the public at large, they would be scandalized that we are behaving in that manner. Now, again, it's an entirely rational type of behavior given the current incentive structure, but it does show, and I do like and I do favor these platforms that support, you know, you publish your paper, a manuscript as a preprint, you get it out there. So they like the eLife model, so which they have now, and they will only actually accept preprints, you know. And I think even that in itself is an important kind of policy tweak towards open access, which is independent funding. And then there is open peer review. And again, I think if one is looking for cost savings, then one of the things that can save costs in terms of time as well as money is actually not having closed review systems, whereby if you fail at one journal, then it's sent out to a whole new set of peer reviewers at another journal who then reread the paper. The peer review should be portable, but of course, commercial interests will be a barrier to that as well. So I think, you know, there are many, I mean, maybe we're getting slightly away from transitional, but it is about how do we get from where we are to open access. And so it's not just about the mechanics of how it's funded. I think it's also about the norms that we set for ourselves about, you know, when is an appropriate time to actually publish your work. And so
I totally agree. And I think what open access and transitional agreements have done, I could argue, although we haven't made that link within the report itself, is it has opened part of that black box up. So I think researchers of those that have benefited from being able to publish open access, they can see often the costs of what it would have cost them to publish their article open access via that route. And also, because they've had an involvement in the negotiations at times, they've been able to have that insight. And so I think the points that you made around those open research systems are really relevant, because I think they need to offer those open research, rapid dissemination of results, benefits to researchers as well. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So Chris, how do you see the report being used, for example, as chair of the content expert group and in your roles? How would you use the report?
So I think it's very useful in evidencing some things that we suspected were the case. I think that's where it's been incredibly helpful. I think once read, once the wider community have had an opportunity to read it, there's an element of simply not being able to unknow what we now know about what has happened over the last few years. I would hope that that would give us an opportunity to have a more international discussion, because I think in this, you know, we recognized for a long time that the UK can't on its own achieve. What we've absolutely seen over the last few years is, whilst we're seeing a growth in these read and publish agreements, an international growth in these read and publish agreements, we've now got the very strong evidence that what they are transitioning is not to a more open access world. So I think that is an international conversation, not just a national conversation. So I think it's going to give us a lot of evidence and a lot of data to support the sort of other decisions and the other discussions that we need to be having both nationally and internationally.
Thank you. Yes, and I'm going to move on now to how we can create that bridge really between where we are now in the transition to open access and also that broader transition to an open research culture. And you spoke a bit about the attributes of a more open research culture and moving away from kind of incentive structures, etc. What do you think might be the next steps? Big question there.
It is a big question. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion and development in this space, I think, and certainly I've seen it from my work with DORA, the Declaration on Research Assessment, and we're very conscious of the intimate links between the wish to improve and make more robust the processes that we use for research assessment and then creating a space for more open forms of sharing, not just the papers, but actually also sharing the data as well. And so, and of course, one can make the argument that the added value for that. I mean, I think that is helping to change things. And my own experience actually on interview panels here at Imperial and on grant review panels for, you know, organizations like the European Research Council, it's much more front and center that, you know, we really have to focus on, you know, the content of the paper or, you know, what have people actually done. So even if you say you have published a Nature paper, then you're much more likely now to get asked in an interview. So it's, well, okay, you have your name on a Nature paper. What did you actually do? You know, they want to know, were you the, you know, was it your idea to do this study? Or did you just, you know, were you told to do the experiment that figure ends up on, you know, panel D of figure 47, you know? So it has changed the nature, and that helps to create more of a space. You know, they, innovations by publishers like PLOS, as Chris mentioned earlier, and eLife and F1000. And, you know, there's still quite a bit of ferment in that area. But how do we get from, you know, from where we are now to where we would like to be? That's still a very difficult task because there are very powerful forces. There's a lot more talk to try and address the fact that the open access, the move towards open access has not really sort of made much inroads in shifting the inequities that existed in the subscription model, whereby people in the global south couldn't afford the subscriptions. And okay, they might have been offered cheap or free subscriptions to some journals, but that was a very patchy ad hoc system that didn't really work from the researchers I talked to in the global south. And in some areas there, particularly I think in Latin and South America, there's already actually a well-established publication system, which is open access, which is largely led by the universities. And certainly what I hear from Latin American researchers is very, you know, frustration about, you know, all of the norms that are kind of imported from Europe and North America about the prestige economy. And they are coming under pressure from their university vice chancellors and whatnot to publish in journals that are, you know, in the indices and that contribute to league table performance and all of that. So while there are good examples, and there's a lot more conversation about diamond open access models, so I think that's, you know, that is one route that is starting to open up within Europe and North America, certainly with Plan S, where there is scope and opportunity for much more progress. We have some really shining examples already. I can think of like the Open Library of Humanities as one particular one. I mean, ultimately what this is in effect is a kind of subscription form of open access, you know, where it's, there are regular contributions that allow then journals to operate that are free to read and free to publish for authors. But what that will need, if we are going to scale it up, is really international agreements among national funders probably to support this sort of mechanism. And maybe, you know, there is a time, perhaps at least a transition period, where the global north, where, you know, historically that is richer for many complicated reasons that we needn't go into right now, you know, could bear the brunt of that cost, you know, on the behalf of the international community writ large, and that might help it. Arriving at that is going to be very complex. And I think also you still do want, you don't want to be creating, you know, one platform to rule them all. You will want still the diversity. You will want some competition within that space to stimulate innovation, but also, you know, regulation, market regulation mechanisms that allow one to control costs a bit more. Now that's a little bit high level, so you can tell I'm not an economist, but that I think is the way forward. And certainly from what I've heard in meetings I've been to in the last 2 or 3 years, is that a lot of interest is focusing to the diamond model as a way of tackling those inequities and controlling cost.
And I think you've given us a blueprint for open research. So thank you, Stephen. I'm going to move on now to our last question, slightly contentious one, possibly. Finally, what would be the one thing you would ask your peers to do or stop doing?
Okay, I have one which is rather provocative and rather bold, which I've been thinking about a little bit for a while, and it would be to stop reviewing for commercial publishers. Now, until they, you know, change their behavior, you know, maybe pay you for your work, or maybe there's a mechanism whereby at the end of the year, they look at, you know, for example, how many of the papers that they published were they either reviewed by or written by researchers working at Imperial College, and then a share of the profits would go to Imperial College, and then Imperial College could use that money to support Diamond Open Access publishing as it saw fit. And so I think it's a power play. That's at the end of the day, that's what we have a public university system in many cases, which is trying to, you know, do work that contributes to the public good. And on the other side, we have commercial operations who are supporting that activity, but charging hefty amounts for it and benefiting from the free labor within it. So I think that might be one challenge. I can see a lot of my colleagues throwing up their hands in horror at this suggestion, but I'm going to make it anyway.
Good. We're glad you did. Chris, over to you.
I mean, what's interesting is that before I answer the question directly, maybe I'll just sort of reflect a little bit on what I've seen over the last 4 or 5 years, and in particular since we've got the UUK JISC content negotiation strategy group, which goes much more broadly than just librarians, which I think its kind of nearest predecessor group was. And I have been really heartened by the quality of engagement with the issues that we've been talking about today, and the willingness amongst the senior leaders, because the group includes vice chancellors, pro-vice chancellors, research, people from research office, education. So it includes representation from what we might call the sort of senior management across our universities. And they are now going and talking to their peers about some of the craziness that they see in the world in which we librarians have been living for some while. So I feel that we're now pushing at an open door. I hear some of this, there's much more engagement amongst the research community and much more understanding amongst the research community of how, in particular, the commercial publishing industry operates. And so I sense that we are at that in the same way that we are now seeing much more rapid take up of rights retention, adoption of rights retention policies at institutions. I'm also sensing that in parallel, we're getting that engagement with the broader issues. And also to go back to what you were talking about with some of the aims of that broadening and looking much more closely at research culture. So it feels to me as though those, you know, we've definitely got feet indoors with that. And so I'm on that front, I'm much more optimistic that we are managing to engage much more widely within our institutions. And then that in itself, you know, with the work that Stephen's done on EDI and with DORA, all of those things come together and collectively are that, you know, that lens onto research culture and how we should be behaving in a research environment. So for me, it's not so much start, or it's just keep pushing that door from all the many angles that we are able to keep pushing at it.
Thank you both. That was absolutely fascinating. So thank you again for your time and for your insights. It's incredible. Thank you.